Breach, your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the era of Trump. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein, and my guest today is Leon Nafik, a legal reporter for Slate. He's been writing about Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, whose memo was supposedly Donald Trump's impetus to fire FBI Director James Comey. Trump later admitted that he had already made up his mind to fire Comey long before that memo. Leon writes that Rosenstein's story is a cautionary tale for all who serve at the pleasure of Trump. Leon, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
On Tuesday, Donald Trump abruptly fired FBI Director James Comey. Can you bring us up to date on the shifting rationales for that decision?
Yes. So the first rationale we heard was basically expressed in a memo from the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, to his boss, Jeff Sessions. And it was a memo that Sessions then cited in his letter to Trump, in which he recommended that Comey be fired. And in his memo, Rosenstein said basically that Comey had screwed up very badly at a couple of different points during the Clinton emails investigation. So he took issue with the way Comey had held a press conference about when he announced that he didn't see the need for charges, the way he criticized Clinton, even though he wasn't prosecuting her. Rosenstein also objected to the letter that Comey sent to Congress in October, a few days before the election, in which he said that actually the investigation was being reopened. Rosenstein basically felt like Comey had undermined the credibility of the FBI through his handling of the email investigation, and as a result, seemed to suggest that a change was needed. He didn't specify that he thought that Comey needed to be fired. He stopped just short of that, interestingly, but it was then used, basically, this memo to justify the firing. And in all the early press conferences and, you know, interviews with, like, the VP and the White House spokeswoman, the memo was cited as, like, the provoking event, basically, that led Trump to make his decision.
But it's odd, given that Trump has praised Comey before, like, as recently as October, and just after the inauguration in January, he gave him a big hug and maybe even blew him a kiss. What's going on here?
Oh, I don't know which to read into the kiss, but he definitely had praised his decisions before. I think he was probably pleased with the effect that the October letter had on the election. You know, sure enough, within a few days, you know, the narrative had shifted, as you suggested. I mean, Trump himself, in an interview that aired yesterday, Thursday, on NBC, you know, basically admitted that actually, I was all set to fire Comey before I even got a memo from Rosenstein. I don't think he actually mentioned Rosenstein's name, but he said basically that my mind was made up before anyone had recommended I do anything. And he even said that when I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something like, when I decided to fire Comey, I thought to myself, this Russia story, it's so made up, it's a hoax. And so he all but admitted that the reason he fired Comey was because of the Russian investigation, which was pretty obvious to anyone watching, you know, as early as Tuesday. But it really put Rosenstein in a bad spot, because it kind of revealed that he had been used basically for his, you know, good reputation and for his persuasive, I think, in many people's eyes, points that he made in his memo, which a lot of people agreed with on its face, but nevertheless felt that Comey's firing was a terrible call at this moment in time.
And Comey wouldn't be the first person closely linked to the Russia investigation to have really negative career prospects under the Trump administration, right?
No, Sally Yates was the first. She was in the news recently as well. So Sally Yates was the Deputy Attorney General, actually the same job that Rod Rosenstein has now, under Loretta Lynch, under the Obama administration. When Trump took over and Loretta Lynch stepped down, Yates was elevated very briefly to the role of acting attorney general, which meant she was, you know, running the Justice Department. And in her capacity as acting attorney general, she found out that Michael Flynn, who is the national security advisor, had had certain inappropriate conversations with the Russian ambassador to the U.S. in which he discussed sanctions. And so this is all based on reporting. She's never really confirmed the details of this, except for the broad outline. You know, having learned that Flynn had these conversations, she observed that the administration's official line was that he hadn't, that, you know, Mike Pence was out there on TV saying that Flynn had never discussed sanctions with the Russians. So Yates saw a discrepancy there, and in her telling, as she testified before the Senate last week, she said that she basically called the White House counsel, Don McGahn, and said, you know, I got to talk to you, and she briefed him on on Flynn's apparent deception. And then basically, I think it was 10 days into her tenure as acting attorney general, she was fired for, you know, seemingly unrelated reason, which was that she refused to, she ordered the Justice Department lawyers not to defend Trump's immigration ban, travel ban in court, which provoked Trump to fire her, predictably. But yeah, so the conversation she had with McGahn happened first, and we don't know what role it played in her firing, though it seems like unlikely that it was a precipitating factor.
Rosenstein himself apparently pushed back really hard against the original White House narrative that he was the impetus for the firing. Why do you think he did that?
Because he felt like a chump, I think, or he knew he looked like one. He was pretty plainly taken advantage of. Like, he was asked to write a memo. You know, the reporting says that on Monday he met with Sessions and Trump in the Oval Office, and Trump was basically like, you know, give me the case for getting rid of this guy and put it in writing for me. And, you know, people were speculating a little bit as to what exactly happened next, but what we know is that Rosenstein sat down and wrote this memo. And we don't know if he thought that the memo was like just the first step in like what would be a more leisurely, more traditional process by which in the end they perhaps would get a new FBI director. But what happened instead was that the memo was immediately used as a pretext to carry out the termination immediately, and was made public in the same breath as the news broke. You know, he'd been sort of used as a getaway driver or something, or like he had laundered the administration's real reasons for wanting to get rid of Comey, and that they had sort of used his, you know, reputation for integrity, his reputation for being apolitical and very professional and respectful of the Justice Department. I think they correctly viewed him as a trustworthy vessel for this decision. Like, I don't know if he felt personally misled, but I think he felt like the White House in put kind of pinning the decision on him and kind of saying that he was the trigger man, so to speak, had been dishonest. And according to, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal, he called again, Don McGahn, the same guy that Sally Yates called the White House counsel and said, look, you guys got to set this right. And it's unclear exactly what he got as a result of that call. There were some reports that he had threatened to quit. He denied that in a brief interview with a reporter. But the White House did put out like an updated timeline of the decision making process that went into the firing. And in that new version, Rosenstein's memo was like fourth on the list after, you know, Trump sort of thinking about it for months and being put off by Comey's testimony before the Senate a couple weeks back. And in that retelling, Rosenstein's memo was maybe the final step, but not the precipitating factor. So that may have been, you know, a bone they threw to him and to keep him from feeling like he was being taken advantage of.
Now, do they have to stay on Rosenstein's good side? If there were a special prosecutor, he would be the person who would be in charge of picking that person, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I don't think they feel like they have to be on his good side. I think he is entirely at their, I think he is serving at Trump's pleasure, and he knows it. I think if they don't want him to appoint a special prosecutor, and he does, they'll just get rid of him, I think.
And what are the options in terms of there being a special prosecutor?
What are the options?
Yeah, like how would that be set up? How would it work? What would the powers be?
I mean, I think he, you know, I should know more about this than I do, but my understanding is that he can act pretty unilaterally in terms of choosing someone, and it's pretty much up to him whether, you know, he could choose a sitting U.S. attorney, he could choose someone who's no longer a U.S. attorney, probably can choose someone who's never been a U.S. attorney. I don't know entirely whether there are certain parameters that the person would have to fill, but I think the important thing from, I think, the public's perspective is that he's someone who incredibly act independently of the White House and the other people who might be under investigation.
Some people have described this as crossing the Rubicon, where Trump has gone past the point of no return by firing the FBI director. Do you think that that's true in the sense of our democratic norms? That, yeah, technically, not just technically, but actually he has the power to fire the FBI director whenever, but the norm was that you didn't do that in anything that might be conceived as a political context, but Trump has just cast that norm aside. Do you think that bodes ill?
I mean, yeah, it bodes ill. I think it's hard to say. It's hard to say it will be decisive, just given how many things have boded ill up to this point so far. I don't know if you can say boded ill in the past tense, but Yeah, I feel like we've gone through this so many times at this point where it like feels like this is the thing. This is the one. This is the one. This is the event that's going to totally change the game. And then he seems to survive and we move on and the next thing happens and we move on. For sure, he has crossed the line that people probably didn't think that he would or certainly hoped that he wouldn't. You know, Clinton didn't fire his FBI director. But yes, it is true that he has crossed the line with this, and it's something that I think previous presidents would have never considered, just because it's politically such an obvious violation to get rid of the guy who you know is conducting an investigation into your, if not you personally, then into your associates and into your presidential campaign.
Let's talk about Jeff Sessions in all of this. The reason we're dealing with Rosenstein and not with Sessions is because Sessions has recused himself from a broad swath of business having to do with the election and the Russian investigation and various other things. Mm-hmm. So why is Trump talking to him about the decision to fire the FBI director if he's supposed to be sitting this one out?
Yeah, that's a good question. And people have wondered whether his involvement in the decision to fire Comey constitutes a violation of his pledge to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. You know, I honestly feel like we don't know a whole lot about Sessions' role in this decision. We know that he sent this letter to Trump on Tuesday. We know that he attended this meeting with Trump and Rosenstein on Monday. But we don't know sort of whether he was pushing for it. If so, we don't know why. I'm frankly been surprised that he hasn't felt compelled to make any kind of public statement about it. I guess no one can force him. But I think if he were asked, or if someone managed to pin him down on this, he would say, well, no, the decision to fire him was based on the Clinton email investigation. I didn't say that I would recuse myself from anything involving Clinton. That's like that has nothing to do with Russia, as did this firing have nothing to do with Russia. You know, that clearly would be very implausible at this point, because we know from the president's own mouth that this firing had very little to do with Comey's handling of the email investigation. Certainly had nothing to do with the notion that he was unfair to Clinton, which is sort of what Rosenstein's letter said. But yeah, I think there's a plausible argument to be made that if you have recused yourself from an investigation, playing a key role in getting rid of the guy who's leading that investigation represents a violation of your recusal pledge. But I think there's like probably enough wiggle room for him to say, like, look, this is a management decision. This is broader than any one investigation. And of course, I have to be involved in this. And like, I didn't recuse myself from anything involving this guy. I mean, he's the FBI director. If your argument is that recusing myself from the Russian investigation means that I shouldn't have been involved in the decision to fire the FBI director, you're saying that basically I had to take my hands off the FBI entirely, and I clearly didn't make that promise.
So somebody could argue that he really can't serve effectively if he can't touch the FBI. And like, perhaps he should recuse himself from being attorney general.
well, he is not so inclined. And I don't know what pressure there is to be exerted on him, considering, you know, even when he was caught having misstated key facts about his contacts with Russian officials under oath to the Senate, considering that didn't really move the needle at all or have any apparent consequence. Well, besides, I guess, putting pressure on him to recuse himself. Considering he survived that, it's going to take more to resign or be removed.
But we've kind of come up against a brick wall in terms of accountability in general, right? It's up to them whether they appoint a special prosecutor. Republicans control the legislative branch. What levers are left to exert accountability and control over what Trump just did?
So I gather, and I haven't like totally learned everything I could about this, but I gather there's things that that Congress can do to basically put a hold on all congressional business until the administration and Rosenstein in particular commits to appointing a special counsel. As you said, Congress is controlled by Republicans, so it's unclear, you know, whether there's any chance that McConnell has said that he doesn't support, you know, he doesn't believe a special counsel is needed, and Rosenstein has said he doesn't. Well, Rosenstein, I should say, testified at his confirmation hearing that he couldn't commit preemptively to appointing a special counsel. And I guess the reporting today, which I saw just before we got on the phone, said that, according to sources, he still doesn't believe that a special counsel is needed. I think in principle, Congress has certain options in terms of putting pressure on Rosenstein, and Rosenstein will be appearing before the Senate next week at some point, so maybe they will talk about it then. But given the political circumstances that we're in, it's hard to game out exactly what it would take for that pressure to actually actually be exerted.
But he seems like kind of a preening sort of guy, someone who's very invested in his reputation for fairness. Do you think that's an opportunity for a good guilt trip?
Well, I mean, so I wrote a piece like last week. Man, it feels like forever ago at this point, but I wrote a piece last week, like after his swearing in, basically saying, like, could this be best hope for bringing professionalism to the Jeff Sessions DOJ and sort of bringing someone in who will serve as a check on his sort of most political instincts and his sort of most aggressively partisan impulses. And I think a lot of people felt that way about his nomination. They were like pretty stoked that there would be like an adult in the room, even though, you know, Rosenstein's like a conservative guy. It's not that he is like some progressive hero. It's that he is a DOJ lifer. He's worked in justice for 27 years. He's had a bunch of different jobs. Everyone knows him. He's been a career attorney. He has served as federal prosecutor in Maryland for 12 years. He was considered so even-handed that even though he was initially appointed by Bush, Obama kept him on. Yeah, he has a sterling reputation. I think he's very invested in it, which I think is probably why I would guess this has all been very difficult for him, because I think his reputation is really on the line. I mean, it's not the most important thing on the line, but it's one of them.
But do you think he might be vulnerable to considering a special prosecutor just because
he
doesn't
have... Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's... I don't know if I put it that way. I mean, maybe I'm naive to sort of trust the consensus view in the legal world about him, that he's this like stand-up guy. And maybe it's like more complicated than that, or maybe, you know, being close to power in the way that he is now sort of would corrupt anyone, even the most conscientious man of integrity. But I don't know. I guess I have a hard time believing anyone can change so much, or that anyone could develop a reputation like that as solid as the one that he has over 27 years, and for it to be like totally not true. So I would say that I would be shocked if he is not thinking seriously about the need for special counsel. I think he's a serious guy. I think he seems, from all accounts, he's an extremely intelligent guy. He knows how this looks, and I would imagine that he's considering it, even if so far he's not convinced that it's needed.
Leon, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
And now it's time for a special comment. Veteran journalist Dan Rather took to Facebook to express his outrage over Donald Trump's abrupt and unexpected firing of FBI Director James Comey. I have lived through nearly 4,500 weeks in my life, and I have never seen a week like the one we just had. I have seen weeks of far greater darkness, of war and death and economic despair. I have seen weeks of more confusion and uncertainty. But I've never seen a week where a president of our nation has behaved with such cavalier disregard for the norms and institutions of our democracy, Rather wrote. In just a few months, Trump has already disregarded basic democratic norms such as not calling to jail your political opponent and not alleging election fraud and not dismissing proof of electoral meddling by a hostile foreign power. Last week, Trump added to the collection of dead norms nailed to his wall by firing his FBI director for nakedly political reasons. Trump admitted to Lester Holt of NBC that the official explanation for Comey's dismissal was a hoax. In the interview, the president contradicted the White House narrative that Comey had been fired for his handling of the Clinton email investigation because the new deputy attorney general recommended it. Trump admitted to Holt that he'd decided to fire Comey long before that memo was written. Even more shocking, Trump admitted that he fired Comey partly because Comey was overseeing a probe into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. In fact, when I decided to just do it, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election that they should have won, Trump said. Later, on Twitter, Trump would scoff at the idea that his spokespeople could accurately convey the thoughts of an active president like himself, and threatened to cancel future daily press briefings. The idea that the president's spokespeople speak for the president is one of the deepest norms of our democracy. Most of what we're told about how and why decisions are taken by the chief executive comes from his surrogates. Abandoning that standard is abnormal and frankly unworkable. If the president's spokespeople no longer speak for him, we've lost transparency in government. Trump is trying to absolve himself of responsibility for any consistency in his message from day to day. He's trying to create a new normal so he can rewrite history and policy on the fly. From now on, Trump and his surrogates aren't lying when they can't keep their story straight. The poor surrogates just can't keep up, and frankly, the fake media are jerks to expect it. This is how authoritarians operate. They want to destroy our expectations of truth and consistency, so we give up and stop demanding answers. Republicans are eager to remind us that the FBI director serves at the pleasure of the president. Indeed, the president can fire the director for almost any reason, or no reason. However, obstruction of justice can turn ordinarily legal acts into crimes if they're done to impede an investigation. It's legal to burn your own papers or delete your own files unless you're doing it to impede an official inquiry. By the same token, it's legal for a president to fire his FBI director pretty much whenever, but not if it's done to obstruct, influence, or impede an official proceeding. Note that allegations of obstruction of justice figured prominently in the cases for impeachment against both Clinton and Nixon. A former federal prosecutor told Politico that Trump was walking a dangerous legal line by admitting that he fired Comey, even partly because of the Russia investigation. To make matters worse, Trump volunteered that he invited Comey to dinner at the White House to talk about his future as FBI director, and at that dinner quizzed Comey about whether he was under investigation. Under the circumstances, such a question could be an attempt to coerce Comey to drop the investigation if he valued his job, which a court might see as yet another attempted obstruction of justice. Officially, the White House hasn't secretly taped visitors since the Nixon era, but this week Trump taunted Comey on Twitter, saying that he'd better hope there are no tapes of our conversations. The fact that Nixon spied on his enemies is a stain on American democracy. The Nixon era went down in history as a terrifying brush with authoritarianism that was averted only by impeachment. It's hard to express what an affront it is for a president to suggest that he's taken up wiretapping in service of blackmail. Furthermore, threatening Comey could be yet more evidence of obstruction. Comey is still a potential witness against Trump, who might be subpoenaed to testify before Congress any day, and Trump's threats could be seen as illegal attempts to influence his behavior. We pride ourselves on the majesty of the Constitution and congratulate ourselves on being a nation of laws, but that's only part of what keeps democracy going. We are also a nation of norms, and we discard them at our peril. Now it's time for recommended reading. Every week on The Breach, I suggest some reading material that elaborates on the themes we discuss on the program. This week's selection is from Seth Maskett in Pacific Standard. It's called The Toughest Death of 2016, The Democratic Norms That Used to Guide Our Political System. It came out in December, and it proved very prescient. There's a part of me that wants to say that Leonard Cohen's was the toughest death of 2016, but in my heart, I know Maskett is right. That's it for recommended reading. Breach is produced by Rewire Radio. Our executive producer is Mark Folletti. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Tweet your suggestions, comments, and questions to @Beierstein, Beyerstein on Twitter. See you next week.